Good afternoon. So last time we talked a bunch about, first, how viruses that and other malware that modifies existing programs can find places to hide their code. So we mentioned this idea that there are these cavities, these holes, these unused spaces in typical executables, and libraries, it turns out, that are places where you can add code, and also that you can do things like what we saw with our first example of appending code. And this also is something you can do on a more modern executable format. There's just extra work we need to do, sometimes at least, to fix up the executable so it will actually load that code. Then we also talked about invoking virus code. And we had sort of the simple strategy that we started with Vienna, which was to just modify the first piece of code that ran. We saw that, well, there's other places you can modify. You don't have to modify where the program starts. So you can like replace a return or a call or something like that. And the only tricky part about that is you need to find them. One strategy is you just look for machine code that's typical of the beginning of functions or function calls and replace it with an appropriate call or jump to whatever malicious code was inserted. Then we started talking about, on the subject of inserting jumps to code, about dynamic linking. This seemed like a diversion. We're going to kind of tie it back because dynamic linking is going to have pointers to code, like jumps that we could also change. And something I mentioned early on when we started talking about dynamic linking is that even though you might think it would work the same as static linking, that having the C standard library loaded when your application starts would give the same result as if we embedded it in the application, like with static linking, it doesn't actually work that way. Typically, there's extra indirection. And we started looking at sort of information about making dynamic linking work in Linux executables. So one thing we discovered is that there's information about what to load in the headers. And we saw the information about this needed file, needed, and the library file, and a table of information. And we're going to look at some details of that, which are going to help us figure out how to, you know, make our executable actually call that library. We also saw that there's this idea of an interpreter, that the actual dynamic linker, it's not included in our executables, so our executables have this pointer called this interpreter field that says where the dynamic linker program is, and it's responsible for interpreting all this information and loading the libraries our program needs. So our first topic for today is we're going to look more at what this extra indirection looks like, and also, you know, about what other information we have besides what library to load in the headers and how that works. But before we get on to that, questions about things we covered last time? Okay, not seeing any. So let's look at our dynamic linking situation. So I mentioned this extra indirection. So that's going to be first thing we'll talk about. And a big part of this extra indirection is that there's this kind of transformation that happens at compile time in these dynamically linked programs. That this program here has a call to puts. Puts is going to be in a library. And when producing the executable that calls puts, what typically happens on Linux, and this is also true in, you know, not with all the details being the same, but something very similar happens on Windows and OS X, is that we create this stub, that's the name, which stands in for the real puts function. And main contains a call to this stub. And you might say, well, why would we do that? Well, the main reason is that we don't want to avoid modifying this call, and we can hard code in the executable this call and have it work no matter where the real copy of PutS is. And to make the real copy of PutS work, we have a table called on Linux, the global lookup table. Global lookup table. On Linux, it's called the global offset table, which is sometimes abbreviated GOT, which has an array of initially placeholders. So in the executable, these aren't the real addresses of the function. And our stub is going to look up an index in this table, and the linker, these are going to be replaced at runtime with a copy of the actual address of PutS. Now, to make this work, something that I haven't shown the details of here that we're going to need is we're going to need something that says that PutS is in this lookup table so we can do this replacement. So I have a picture version of this that we have our executable, and in our executable, we have our call to PutS. It actually points to this stub, which does a lookup in this global offset table. And we have information that says, oh, this entry of this table should be PutS in what is called the dynamic relocation table. This is the name you'll see when you use, say, object dump. And what's going to happen is our program is going to be loaded into memory. So we have our part that's loaded into memory. So that includes our global offset table, which is the initial values, and so on. And after we do that, the dynamic linker is going to load our C library. And it's going to use this information that, oh, the C library is here. The C library is PutS should go here. And it's going to link this up to the loaded C library. So now our call to PutS will end up going to the right place, but with this extra layer of indirection. So questions on what I'm showing on this picture with this indirection for this call to PutS? So a question is, what's the difference between the global offset table and the dynamic relocation table? So the global offset table, this is the sort of runtime array, of pointers. And the dynamic relocation table is the mapping from array entries or to names, basically. So this global offset table doesn't actually say that this is for PutS. All you see is that this is an array of pointers. So we need that extra information in the executable to let us know what actually goes there. Also, it's going to churn out, that we could have information about other things that map to names. This is not typical, but the dynamic relocation table is just generally a table of here are the places where particular names go in the executable. It just happens that usually all those names are in this global offset table. So there's two tables actually that we're going to be concerned about. So one is this table of this relocation table, which has entries known as relocation records, which is the list of the functions and variables that our executable uses with the locations to fill in. To make that work, we also need what's known as a symbol table, which is in the library in libc, we need to know where's PutS. So there's a table in libc that says, this is where PutS is, and it's called the symbol table. And the dynamic linker is going to read that so it knows that it needs to go here and not at some other location in libc. And if you pass the right address to object dump, you can see these tables. So for example, we can see the dynamic relocation record and the way this works is that we have this address here and the name. You can see the name is actually annotated with what version it expects to find in the library. And this is the address in the global offset table, and our jump instruction here specifies that address, albeit relative to the current program counter. And so the dynamic linker is going to read this table to fill in the address that this jump instruction in this stub here expects. Now, it would seem that, okay, so we're done. There's nothing else to happen with dynamic linking, but there's often a bit of a complication. That if we look at the case of this stub, and we look at what's in the initial value of the global offset table, we see that there's this value here in my executable, which is an actual address. So my global, this is my global offset table here as a bunch of bytes, and here is the value of 404018, the thing that's going to be filled in by the dynamic linker. And we can see that what the linker that produced this executable didn't leave this blank. It filled it in with an address, which is a real address in the program. And you might say, well, why did it do that? Why didn't it just leave this as a bunch of zeros? Like, it's going to fill it in anyway. And the answer is that it filled it in with an address that points to this linker calling stub. So there's a little bit of code that calls the linker. That's the initial value of the global offset table entry. Sorry, I have this line drawn incorrectly. So when we load the program, before we actually load, you know, libc and set this entry, it points to this linker calling stub. So this is a little piece of code. We can see it. This little piece of code here. And the idea is that if the linker doesn't fill this in and we call puts, it will run this little piece of code here, which will call the dynamic linker. And the linker can use this to not fill in the actual entry for the puts until after it's called. And this is something known as lazy binding. So the way this would work is that we have our initial load of the global offset table has this linker routine in the executable. And on the first call to puts, we don't really call puts. We call this linker routine, which fills in the global offset table for next time, then jumps to puts. And then after that, it fills in. So after that, we filled this in, and the later calls won't call the linker again. You might say, so why would we bother doing this? Why wouldn't we, since we have to do a bunch of work when we load this libc here, why wouldn't we just set the entry immediately when we load? Why would we wait? Why would we do this, as it's called, lazy thing of filling it in when puts is actually called? Because doesn't that just seem like more work overall? And, well, some people would say you shouldn't do it. But sort of the big advantage of it is that it can lower the overhead in the common case. That, in particular, we can load programs much faster because now loading our program doesn't involve setting all the entries in the global offset table, which for an executable that calls a couple hundred library functions could be a lot. It also means if you have library functions that aren't used much, and often there's a lot of them, or, you know, they don't always get called, then you don't have any overhead for setting them up. But the disadvantages are that, well, one thing is that this can mean that errors won't be detected until later. So, for example, let's say we're calling a function in libc, you know, f put c and, or some, f put c is not a good example, but some function that, you know, gets removed in a later version or doesn't exist in an earlier version. Well, we might not get an error about that until we actually try to call it with this technique. And if we call all the functions, this is probably more overhead. Another disadvantage that will come up a bunch when we talk about exploits is that this seems to mean that the global offset table needs to be writable when that might not otherwise be necessary. So your question is, why does it fill the entire global offset table and not just put at? So I'm not sure what you're referring to. So when we load our program initially, the first step is going to be to copy the executable into memory. So at that point, the global offset table has all the values that were in the executable, which are sort of our template values. With lazy binding, these template values are probably going to point to this linker calling stub that's actually going to fill in the entry for putS. With non-lazy binding, what the linker will do at this point is before it starts the program, it will instead fill in all the entries from the table. So both are valid options, and we have these pros and cons between. Questions about lazy binding and this indirection in general. I suspect I'm not hearing people. Let me fix this. Hi, Zoom. Why, Zoom? Did you? Okay, so you can speak again now that I have my volume not set at like 10%.
So do you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. So then just about the GLT. So like, how is it for the non-lazy way, right? You're saying it's being, all those entries are being loaded into memory, whether it's being used or not, right?
So for the non-lazy way, we copy all the entries from the executable and then the initial values, which are going to be junk, right? Mm-hmm. And then we fill them all in with pointers to our like libc or wherever whatever library they actually go to.
Do you still need to use the linker calling stub if you've already loaded everything?
So in the case where we're doing the non-lazy binding, this linker calling stub is not used.
Okay.
It's not a big deal because it's not that much code. Because the way it basically works on Linux is it pushes the index in the global offset table and then calls an entry in the global offset table, which is always filled in. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so one more. So that's sort of how we fill in executables. Now, one thing we haven't looked at is how libraries are loaded. And one thing that's peculiar about libraries is that, well, they look like executables, but if you look at them, they'll usually say that they're being loaded at address 0. And this is kind of a special case. So this is a libc.so. You see it's marked as dynamic. And this indicates that, well, it's for dynamic linking. And the dynamic linker is actually going to choose a different address to load it at. And generally, these libraries are set up so they can be loaded at multiple locations. And that means that their assembly code needs to be written with that sort of relative addressing that we mentioned earlier when we were talking about sort of writing, you know, virus code. Something like to note, which is why I'm highlighting this for libraries, is that if you look at executables on a modern system, often they'll work the same way. That if I look at a typical executable on Ubuntu 20.04 that I compile with default options, you'll see that it gets loaded at these really low addresses. And if you actually run it, the code won't be loaded to this address. So these are known as position-independent executables. So the same sort of way that dynamic libraries, the dynamic linker chooses where to load them, The dynamic linker can also choose where to load the executable itself, and the way executables opt into this is by setting this dynamic flag here. I have the wrong vadder I would highlight here. This address 0, which is not actually where it will end up. Okay, so just wanted to mention that.
In terms of being loaded at those small, because I thought we said before, right, that I thought every executable had to be loaded like past that 4,400 whatever, like that memory space at least. So are these loaded before that space?
So the question is, are there restrictions on what address the executable can actually be loaded to? So the OS will typically have, typically has a convention about sort of what range of addresses it will load things to, but this is basically up to how things are configured in the OS and the dynamic linker, what address actually this gets mapped to. And that's, so if you configure the OS and the dynamic linker, maybe it would actually use this address, but most likely it's going to choose some address that, on modern systems is actually often random. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. And there's a question, is each executable given their own virtual memory segment so two can load at, say, 0x400? So generally, each executable that's run will have its own address space, as it's called. You'll learn about how these work if you take operating systems. But the sort of short version of it is that each executable gets the appearance that it has all the addresses to itself, and the OS implements this by actually making those addresses map to different underlying locations in memory. Now, just to be careful about this, so that's the memory I'm referring to here, but when an executable loads a library, the library has to be at a different location than the executable because they both call each other. Whereas if we have two programs that are running side by side, they don't call each other. They have to go through the OS to communicate with each other. Does that answer that question? Okay. Now, we've looked at sort of the ways that the linker works, and something you might notice from a perspective of thinking about virus code to invoke things is that we have some interesting candidates here. So we have some jumps that could be replaced with a jump to virus code at well-known locations in the executable. This is a very regular pattern. Also, we have these pointers here to something that, is going to be run. And this is another thing that, hypothetically, virus code could replace this. And if you want to, you could say, cross this out and make it be, virus function. So these are other places where we could insert jumps to invoke or virus by taking advantage of how the dynamic linker works. Now, here I'm giving examples where we modify an executable, but there's a more interesting case, which is has been seen a bunch in the wild, which is modifying libraries. So libraries have their symbol table that says where each function is. And for example, on Windows, kernel 32.dll is basically a standard library. It has a symbol table. Get file attributes A is a useful function you'd call on Windows to get information about a file. And there's been some viruses which just say, okay, they append themselves to this standard library for Windows and update the symbol table to point to there. And they can keep a copy of where that used to be and jump back to it so it even looks like normal operation. So this is another way viruses can get invoked, is by taking advantage of that. The dynamic linker is filling in these pointers. You can just change where it makes the programs jump to by updating this symbol table. So there's a question, hey, wouldn't this appending not work due to load operation. So part of doing this is going to be updating this header here to make it so the dynamic linker knows that there's more stuff in the library to load into memory. Other questions, follow-ups? Okay. And I guess one other thing that viruses have been seen to do in the wild, more so than this one, is that you could also update the list of needed libraries to add, you know, your virus library, which is something that some viruses have seen to, like, just add code to load an additional library, which is malicious. Another way of taking advantage of the dynamic linker and avoiding a lot of the complication of, like, trying to embed things and jumps and executables. Now, another issue that comes up a lot for viruses and malicious code in general with dynamic linking is that things like viruses want to call the standard library. That, you know, it's really annoying to write code without functions like open, printf, you know, all these functions you probably would like to use. And these are part of the standard library. And if we're writing code that we're inserting in applications, we'd like to call these functions. And the way it works in applications is that the application calls that stub that the dynamic linker generates, and that's done automatically by the process of producing the executable. But this doesn't work so great in our virus code that we're inserting maliciously into a program, because the stubs are going to be at different places for different applications, because what the linker does is it looks at what functions are you actually using and it generates all those stubs. And, you know, depending on which functions you used, that will change where the stubs are and what order they're in. So commonly virus code that needs to deal with this, especially Windows where this came up a lot more, because on Windows it's pretty hard to write code that doesn't make library calls relative to Linux, is that one thing they do is they'd hard code where they think the libc, the standard library, would end up in memory. And that meant that when things got upgraded, their virus stopped working, but, you know, not that, you know, still worked enough. You could try to rewrite the library function yourself on Windows, possible, but challenging. Easier on Linux because the source code is easier to find. You could scan the linker data structure. So you could figure out where the symbol table is the same way the linker does and read that. So this is a common strategy, but it also means that this is something that antivirus software can search for and has. Another option is you could, like, make a new executable or library and load it. Questions about this idea about, you know, dealing with our virus code calling libraries. Okay. Now, question, what's the difference between option 2 and 4? Here. So this last option, I mean that we're not going to, we're gonna probably call the standard library. The goal is that we run the dynamic linker to load the library. With option 2, our goal is that we make a new version of the library ourselves, Okay. Also, as a preview for the future, so in a couple weeks, we'll be talking about memory error exploits. So turning things like buffer overflows and seg faults into running malicious tasks. And a common goal in there that we're going to see is converting a memory overwrite so that we have some way of modifying memory we're not supposed to into actually running code. And this is one reason we're talking a bunch about the global offset table, because more so than it might be useful to know for writing viruses, for writing exploits, for doing this task of taking something that writes memory you're not supposed to and running code, it's really useful because it's a bunch of function pointers in a known location. So if you can overwrite memory and you can make that overwrite of memory overwrite the global offset table, well, you can probably get something to jump to a location you specified. So that's preview for the future, but something to keep in mind. So you hopefully remember it when we get to that topic later in the semester. So, we're going to look next at, now that we kind of know our options for good enough. For causing virus code to be invoked, asking a question here, like if we think about writing software to find these malicious code, which should be easiest or hardest to identify? And by replace start location, I mean, this is like in our ELF header, the start location, not the first piece of code that runs. Give another 20 seconds or so.
When a antivirus program is looking at executables, how does it determine what the initial state should be?
So that's a good question. How do we find out the initial state of what it should look like? And the answer is you often don't have that information, right? Because if we think about how the most common use for antivirus software is that we kind of expect it to work on a system that it's never seen before, with programs it's never seen before. Now, if you had a known good state, well, you could use that. But often that doesn't really have a reliable way, which is why we have this false positive issue. So as far as easiest, we have kind of a consensus that A or F seems easiest. And as far as hardest, we have F or probably some version of D, sorry, which I split the answers differently in the poll than there. So someone wanted to defend why they think replace start location would be easy to find. Text, you can do chat or speaking. Chat.
It seems easy to check if something modified a program versus I mean, I chose this one because of the false positive contingency, whereas with a new automatically started assisted program, it seems like you don't necessarily can guarantee that it's malicious, but with the star location, you see who changed it, was it from an update, or a trusted source. If it wasn't, then it seems like
okay. Pretty high. So your theory is that, you know, if we observe this changing, that seems suspicious.
Mm-hmm. If it's not from who we'd expect.
Okay, so you have this idea from who we'd expect. So that seemed... Okay. Yeah. So that gives us this idea that we want to, like, kind of check for changes. So the idea of, like, monitoring the system for changes is a nice one, but often not sort of the approach that antivirus software ends up being able to use. And the big reason why is that a lot of our common scenarios for antivirus software are like, you got an email with an executable, is it okay? And for that sort of scenario, like, we can't observe who changed the start location, we just have an executable with a weird start location. But it's probably a good instinct that, oh, the start location, this has a regular way we expect it to look, and it's also a place that's easy to look for, that we know exactly where the start location is. It's one thing to check versus, like, D here, where we have a whole bunch of things we need to check in the executable. So I think it's a reasonable choice. And there's a question of, like, what our scenario is, and we'll look at sort of, well, particular ones later. We're going to focus mostly on this sort of, I have an executable, is it okay, scenario. Because that is where a majority of the work on the antivirus software has gone. And this happens because you end up having people get email executables, they insert some USB key with an executable, things like that. And those are the cases you need to handle. Other comments? And, oh, someone says, bootloaders don't change often. Does this make bootloader location easy to detect? Yeah, so I think bootloaders would be one of my easier ones. And the big reason why is because they don't change often and because you could probably make a list of all the bootloaders that people are likely to use, which you really can't do for these other categories because there's so many different executables with their own sort of patterns for what things look like. But for bootloaders, like, you can, there's probably, like, not more than 20 of them that people actually use. And you could just enumerate all what all of them look like. But probably the case for why it might be difficult is that you'd have to know to look there. But I don't think that's hard. Okay, so we're going to talk about anti-malware software in earnest. So it's virus and antivirus. And this is often described as a sort of cat and mouse game, that the antivirus software is chasing after the viruses and the viruses are changing how they work. And like a Tom and Jerry cartoon, there's never going to be an actual resolution where one of them catches the other forever. Because we mostly do not have actually sort of principled ways that are guaranteed to get rid of malicious software. We're kind of stuck with, you know, doing something that mostly works and having the malware change maybe less if it's possible, but it's still... And we're going to focus mostly on this problem of detecting malware, and that we have a system with executables on it. We want to figure out, is there malware? But some of you had this idea, especially, you know, this instinct that we want to observe changes. And this is sort of a real technique we can do to detect malware. So, for example, there's an open source tool called Tripwire. From about 2000. There's also a company built around it. I know nothing about what the company does. But this open source tool is targeted at servers with professional administrators. And the idea was that you'd run this tool, and it would just record the state of all the system files, including like hashes of every single file in some secure location. And later you'd run the tool, and it would tell you if anything changed. And this was meant to detect malicious software. And it's a great, very simple way of detecting malicious software, because it detects all changes. And this works, but it's not something which is generalizable. So if you think of running a server, which is what they were targeting, you think, I load the software on the server, I'm not upgrading it unless I decide to upgrade it, so I know these things aren't supposed to change. But if we think of running this on a normal system, well, what are you supposed to do with the info about what changed? In particular, you have like a couple concerns. So one is that we have like normal software updates, that if the program's changed, that doesn't necessarily mean anything's wrong, especially on a system that's used by normal people where they're likely to make updates, and sometimes they're updated in different ways. So who knows if that program that modified the executable was the normal software update or some sort of malware. Another issue is that, you know, the malware might be in files that we don't think to look at. That, you know, just because that's supposed to be a directory of data files doesn't mean there isn't a program in it. Just, you know, that's, and sort of Tripwire's idea is that it would look at the files you'd expect to change. And the other big changes is that it could have been compromised before the setup, that if you ran the tool and you already had malware, well, this technique is never going to tell you that. So there's a question, wouldn't this detect all database changes? So yes, if you have data files that are supposed to change, that's a place where absolutely malware could hide, like a database you'd have would do that. And if you're thinking about the records that this program has, they just typically, the idea is you'd have that stored in some other system that would be safe, as far as the like list of hashes to compare to. Now, a sort of related idea is that you could do this idea, you know, of application whitelisting, that we're only going to let things from a trusted source run. And this is not an uncommon thing people do in corporate environments. So for example, Windows 10 has this feature called AppLocker that's targeted at companies which want to control what software runs on their computers. And it lets you control what applications and files users can run. And basically the way it works is that the administrator sets a bunch of rules and it can say what publishers are allowed, as well as file hashes and locations. And the biggest one is this idea of publisher. So that idea of we want to get software from trusted sources. So the idea here is that someone who makes programs for Windows will cryptographically sign their applications, and they'll have a name from that cryptographic signature. And that if we're doing any sort of malware technique, this will, you know, break that signature. And this is a way we can limit what actually runs. And if there's no signatures, you have these fallbacks that you can specify. Here's the hash of the file that I know is okay, of the executable I know is good, or some locations, like if you have something controlled by the system administrator, where they know that they don't let anything other than stuff they've audited go in there. So this is a potential malware, you know, prevention technique that we just like strictly control what we allow to run. And hopefully our publishers don't distribute us software, you know, Adobe, etc., don't give us software that's infected with malware. And this seems pretty good, but it's not great. It's not something people are often willing to use. And the biggest issue isn't even that publishers will give us malicious software, but that, well, programs aren't perfect. They're going to have features and bugs that malware can exploit. So for example, AppLocker's documentation says, AppLocker does not control the behaviors of applications after they are launched. Applications could contain flags passed to functions that signal app locker or to circumvent the rules or allow another exe or DLL to be loaded. So observation is that, you know, some applications have ways of loading other programs. Malware could use that. Doesn't mean the application doesn't have that feature to be malicious. Might be like for loading plugins or something like that. Also, if your users want to install new software or develop software, this kind of scheme is just not acceptable, pretty much. That all the changes to what software is allowed to run need to go through the sysadmins. They can't do things. So this sort of policy, when companies have it, often is considered very sort of hostile to people actually getting their work done, because getting their work done might involve installing or developing software. And the other issue is that this doesn't deal well with interpreted code. And malware, you know, sometimes is written as, you know, something like Perl or Python interpreted code. Now, this idea of whitelisting, so it exists for like normal applications, but it's not very practical. It is actually used a lot in the world of bootloaders. So a common feature of modern, I should say, BIOSes, PHY, is something called secure boot. And the idea here is that the code on the chip on the motherboard checks the bootloader code and fails if it's not okay. So it has this feature where it doesn't allow you to just insert any bootloader there, but only allows you to insert authorized ones. And the way this works is with cryptographic signatures, that the bootloader, we have a bootloader and we have a cryptographic signature for the bootloader. And unless there's a valid cryptographic signature, so someone who's a known authority, that's one of the public keys listed in the chip on the motherboard that wrote the bootloader, only those will work. And this is good for preventing people from running malicious bootloaders, but you have this issue then that only legitimate bootloaders can run. What if I want to run some unauthorized OS on my system? And their solution for that is that you can add keys. I guess I should cross out in theory because I've done this before and had it work. So you can add keys to the list on the BIOS or UEFI, and the process for doing that is designed in such a way that hopefully it's not something that malware can trick a user into doing. It involves like rebooting the system and doing something before an OS loads. Now, this deals with changes to bootloaders. It doesn't deal with sort of the very related problem of what about malware which changes the OS. And the hope there is that the bootloader can like authenticate that the OS is okay. If you have a bootloader that, you know, basically does these cryptographic signature thing with another level. So questions about this sort of secure boot idea? Okay, so those were a bunch of ideas on sort of whitelisting what programs we want to let run and looking for changes. But typically, that's not something we can do. So instead, we're going to try to look at an existing executable and have this idea of looking for the signature of known malware in there. We use the term signature because that's what antivirus software uses. And we're going to talk about, well, what do we want signatures to look like? And there are many sort of ideas we might have. And let's think about our old example of Vienna. So we have a bunch of ideas as far as what we would look for in Vienna, you know, to detect it in executables. And there's these trade-offs here that some of these are going to be faster than others. Some of these are going to have more false positives or negatives. So in terms of false, in terms of, you know, having not detecting things, note that we want to look for Vienna. And ideally, we like this to still work if someone edits Vienna very slightly. Because that's something which really happened. There's really, you know, actually 100-ish different variants of Vienna, it seems. And the way we're going to produce the signature, sort of a background here, is that probably we're going to start with an example infected file, you know, sort of our, as our basis for what we're going to look for in other executables. Give another 30 seconds or so. Okay, so let's start with performance. So most of you have said, and I think, which gets to our point, is that E is the max performance. And I think I would agree that that's probably the fastest thing. And the intuition here is that this is the reads the least of the executable file. Z, and compares the least things. So, whereas these other things, we need to like look at a lot of bytes, do lots of comparisons. So it seems to me that E is probably fastest, but I can see the case for A because it's a simpler comparison. B, arguably simpler. But I think E is probably fastest because we're doing the least work as far as actually reading data from the executable. For minimizing false positives, a majority of you said C. So false positive means we say it's a virus and it's not. And I think because the virus's machine code that copies it to a new file is a subset of the machine code that we found in our example file, that clearly C is not, is going to have more false positives than B, or at least as many false positives as B, because, you know, we should match all the files that match C should match B, all the files that match B should match A. And I think it's likely that A, B, and C have roughly the same number of false positives, but it's possible that we might find code that copies some code to a new file in a legitimate executable, maybe. So there could be a slight chance of more false positives here, but you know, because we're not looking at the actual sort of code that, you know, actually like chooses the files and so on, that would be included if we looked at all the machine code found. That was part that the virus added. And for maximizing true positives, we have a lot of people like C or A. And so I think A, I think, would not maximize true positives because it doesn't ignore, because ignoring the parts that change on reinfection should definitely identify more instances of Vienna. So I think B, so for true positives, I think B is great, better than A, and C would detect a lot of changes to the virus and still get detection, so I think C is better than that. And then we had sort of a debate about whether E is more reliable than C, and that's, it's hard to say, right? Because the question is someone going to change the code in Vienna that copies itself, or the, or where you insert the jump? Hard to say. And D, I think, is another case where it seems like this would have a better true positive rate because it can detect, it can survive a lot of changes to the virus. Like, as long as the virus modifies executables, we'll detect it with D. There's a false positive question here because programs might modify executables for legitimate reasons. But it seems like a pretty good strategy for true positives. And generally, what I want you to get here is that we have this kind of trade-off, that we have a bunch of things here that are not going to be particularly fast, especially D. D seems really slow. But the slower ones tend to be better at avoiding false positives, like we're not going to trigger on normal applications that like might legitimately have code to jump to the end. And as far as, you know, dealing with what if someone changes the virus slightly, like something like D or C are more likely to survive changes to the virus code and detect future variants versus A or B. So questions about sort of my assessment of these options. Okay, so generally, we're going to be looking primarily at these kinds of ways of making signatures that we're looking for a particular machine code. Now, this is not to say that other techniques aren't good, but by far, what most antivirus software focuses on is this type of signature matching, looking for particular pieces of machine code. And we want to have some flexibility. We don't want to just look for like the static machine code. We want to like ignore parts that are going to change. We want to like look for subsets that we think are going to stay the same in future variants. And also that might be faster to look for. So we need some way of representing that. And you might say, okay, so here's a copy of Vienna, and we want to like represent, here's our assembly code. We want to like represent this machine code and say we want to find it. We want to represent that, oh, this changes here, and so on. So we're going to look at like how we represent patterns like this, and we're going to use, as it turns out, a lot of antivirus software uses regular expressions. And as far as we're concerned, regular expressions are a way of specifying patterns in a restricted way that, importantly for us, allows for very fast implementations to find those patterns, and to find those patterns even in cases where we don't have things that would be helpful, like knowing they're always at the end of a file. And our homework assignment next week, called Lex, is going to be using this to find some sort of malware-like patterns and making a program which will search for them, where the idea is that you could easily extend this to have many hundreds or thousands of patterns, and it would still be pretty fast. So there are lots of implementations of regular expressions. For the sake of looking at something concrete, we're going to target Flex, which is not actually meant to be a sort of antivirus engine. Flex is meant for generating parsers, meaning for like parsing like a C program. But it uses regular expressions to do this, so you know that's why we're going to target it. And it supports this pattern language, and I'm going to show you what that pattern language looks like, and then either today or next time we'll look at like how we can apply this to matching machine code and how we can, you know, get the flexibility. So in these patterns, they're a list of characters, like it's basically a little programming language, and alphanumeric characters match themselves. Some non-alphanumeric characters might need a backslash. So to match the string C++, we need to have C backslash plus backslash plus. And there's some other special ways to match characters. So if you went to like new lines or tabs, or importantly for us in matching machine code, a particular character specified by hex, you can use, like you would in C, strings, you know, a backslash sequence to represent that. And Flex, because it's written for C, is going to work by byte. You can represent ranges of characters. So here I'm showing a range of letters. We could also like use this to represent sort of a range of byte values. If, for example, we knew we had, you know, a bunch of different opcodes that could be used somewhere or something like that. As a special case, a dot matches any character except new line. So to match any character, meaning any byte, we use dot or new line. And this is a general syntax for either the first thing or the second thing. So questions on this syntax so far?
I understand some patterns, but like I don't. What is this generally like for? Like how are we going to be using this?
So this is generally for. So we're going to be using this to look for things in file, to look for patterns that are going to correspond to particular machine code in files. This is not like what Flex is mainly designed for, but Flex is going to produce fast matching because that's what it's meant to do. So we're going to not match. Like it's originally designed for like C code, we're going to match, you know, particular stuff that we'd find in executables that were infected with viruses.
Is that like particular, like in terms of like names or like the actual contents of the file?
So our typical patterns, what we're going to look for is like the machine code we'd expect to find in a malicious file. So let me find where I put that. So for example, we might say, oh, Vienna inserts this machine code in a file, so I just write out the machine code as bytes, and I'm going to indicate I found that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And these patterns are more general than that, so I can deal with what about that the fact that parts of Vienna change? Well, I can match any byte in the machine as a placeholder. So I can deal with, oh, there's this byte, then some stuff that changes. And we're going to take advantage of that to have like more flexibility than just looking for a fixed string. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
Okay. So Yeah, so I'm just showing sort of the features. We'll go to applying them to finding malicious code a bit. You can also match multiple copies of things. So A star matches 0 or more A's. A 3,5 matches 3 to 5 of a thing. We can 3 to 5 A's. We can match 3 to 5 ABCs using parentheses. We can match thing or the other like you saw earlier. So there's a question here. What is this I here? So this matches B, C, D, E, or F. That's represented by the B through F part. Or I, which is why there's an additional I here, because that's not part of the range. And I guess as a general note, like A, B, C would match A or B or C, and like A, F would match A or F. Does that answer any other questions about any of this syntax? And question is about here, everything inside after is the not. Yeah, so this caret syntax here means that it's anything but the character specified by what's listed after in the square brackets. So I'm just showing the syntax quickly. This is mainly here so you can look it up when you do the assignment, not because I expect you to memorize this. So sort of the primary intention of Flex is that you can use this to like match code. You know, you can match, say, words ending with ing, or like C++ comments. This pattern is match a slash, a star, which we have to use a backslash because it's special otherwise, followed by any number of non-star characters or a star character not followed by a slash, followed by a star character followed by a slash. This is an example of a pattern to match a comment. To give an example of sort of the intended use of Flex, but we're going to use it to match patterns that are machine code. Now, I've shown you sort of the pattern syntax. Because we're going to use it in the assignment, I need to talk a little about the mechanics. And this is what a typical Flex file will look like. And it's designed to produce a program that does pattern matching. So it has three sections, which are separated by these double percents. The first part has declarations, and what's going to happen is that this is going to turn into a C file, and these declarations are going to be at the top. This middle part is going to turn into a parser for the patterns, and then we'll have the bottom part at the bottom. So the idea is that Flex is the tool that's going to produce a parser for you, but you provide the rest of the C code to include in an executable that includes that parser. And for the parser, we specify our patterns, and we specify code to run when these patterns are matched. So here I say when you find a foo, we increment num bytes and num foos by one. When we find a dot, we increment num bytes by one. When we find a new line, we increment num lines by one and num bytes by one. And that's what our parser does. And our parser is going to be translated into a C function called yylex. So in my main function here, I call that, and it's going to read from standard in, write to, and look for patterns, and run these pieces of code when it finds each of these patterns. It's going to look for one pattern at a time. So when we find foo, you know, so if our input is say foo x new line x, it's going to run this, the foo matching code for the foo and the anything matching code for x and the new line matching code for the new line and the anything matching code for x. It's never going to run this, you know, this anything matching code for foo, things that match foo. Only one match is going to cause code to be run. So questions about how this ends up working.
So if there are multiple matches, it does it sequentially.
So the question is, if there are multiple matches, it does it sequentially. That I believe so. Yes, that it does it in this order. That will take the first one that matches.
So we should order them in like levels of specificity.
Yes. So the question is, you should order by specificity. Yeah. So I've shown you that we can look for matches, and in this case, we're counting the number of matches of each type in a way which gives us the number of bytes, the number of lines, and the number of foods in a file. And we could easily extend this, and that's sort of where we're getting with our idea of using this for finding malware, where instead of looking for foos, we could look for machine code that's suspicious, and in one pass over a file, we could find how many instances there were of all our patterns for suspicious machine code. So one other thing about how it gets converted to C code is that sometimes we'll want to use what matched the pattern. So here I have a program which prints out all the words that start with an A in a file, and the way it works is that this is a pattern which matches a word starting with A, and when my little piece of code that runs when that pattern is matched is running, the variable yytext contains that string. So we can use this to like do some custom processing on our matches. Questions? Okay. So another thing is that sometimes it might be rather tedious to write these patterns. So for example, you might find ourselves writing this a lot. We can specify these sort of macros for our patterns in the top section. So here I'm saying the macro A matches little lowercase a or uppercase a, the macro lowers matches a through z inclusive, and I can use those later on rather than rewriting this pattern. You can think of kind of like a definition. This is like a sort of variable declaration or like a function declaration to make it so we can make our patterns easier to read. So this is what I had before. This is just the same thing, but I've sort of modularized it a bit. So it might be easier to change things later on. Like if I decide, oh, I want to count, like add like an AI with an accent to this list of lowercase characters or something like that. Okay. So this is how we use Flex. And this is as a regular expression engine, and I think we'll pick this up later, but sort of the big reason why we like regular expressions is that there's this efficient representation of all these patterns where we can go character by character and simultaneously look for the entire set of things using a state machine. Now, we're not going to go into super detail about this because this is hopefully something covered in 3201. But if we have this, for example, we can represent this as a state machine, and we can sort of annotate what happens when we, you know, don't see what we expect. And what Flex is going to do, and we'll go through an example of what this looks like next time, is it's going to produce a C program which has a table for each of these states, and it's going to keep track of whether it's in state 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6. And it's going to know in state 1, if I find an F, I go to state 2. If I find a new line, I go to state 6. If I find something else, I go to state 5. And so on. And it's just going to do a table lookup character by character. And because we're just doing a table lookup, even if we have the version of this diagram for like a million patterns, it's still going to be pretty fast to match. And for this reason, you know, antivirus software is often built primarily around doing this kind of pattern matching over files, because you can have this efficient implementation where we do single character lookups in a table that we can build from all the patterns together and use that to find out where they appear in our files. Questions about this? So next time we'll go over what that state machine matching looks like, and sort of we'll review like what it looks like when we start applying it to something, some real virus like Vienna, where, you know, what the patterns might look like. And then we'll talk about, you know, how, you know, the next step, because we had our cat and mouse game of, well, what are we going to do to defeat these patterns if we're a virus author. Okay, so that's where I'll finish up. I'll take questions before I sign off.
When will the answers for the last homework be released?
Not until Wednesday at the earliest, because that's the late deadline.
Gotcha.
Other questions?